And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now are Abby Barrows, a leading microplastics research scientist and founder of Deer Isle Oyster Company, a regenerative oyster and kelp farm, and Dr. Sally Rocks, an associate professor of chemistry at Utah Valley University. Thank you so much for taking part in This Green Earth today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, there is a lot to cover in the world of plastics and microplastics. It's such an important topic. So I'm really glad that you've joined me on the show today. We use plastics on a minute-to-minute basis in our lives, and they're popular in our society for a reason, but they're also detrimental in so many ways. But let's first get a brief history of plastic, its origins, and what we're using it for now, and the many ways in which it's being utilized in our society. Who wants to tackle that?
I'm happy to start. And then Sally, I'm sure I'll have some gaps that you could hop in on.
Sure.
I mean, plastic is an incredible material, but it really has only come into household use since the 1950s. Plastics was a term first coined at the turn of the century, and there weren't that many plastics in common household use. And it was right around the time of the war that we started producing a lot of different types of plastic and adding in different chemicals and really pushing the single use and disposable lifestyle for convenience. And since the 1950s, plastic production and the types of plastics has just risen dramatically each decade. And now we are dealing with a plethora of plastics that contain up to 16,000 different chemicals.
And I would add that plastics originally were supposed to be something that saved us, that was great for the environment. And people really didn't understand the long-term implications. So for example, one of the first plastics was something called Bakelite. And it's hard and white, and it was seen as an alternative to ivory. And people made pool balls out of it, and they thought, this is wonderful because we're saving elephants. Mm. But then what do you do with the Bakelite?
Right.
So it's had a lot of different miraculous uses, but we're always stuck with the then what problem.
Yeah, so right, we are in that now what stage, because although perhaps the origins of plastics and many of their uses are truly beneficial and have been convenient in our lives, the depths to which they are part of our lives, we're finding is coming a little too close to home. We're finding evidence of them in our blood, in our brain, and these are the microplastics. Can you define what microplastics are and how tiny they can actually be?
The term microplastic was coined about 20 years ago, and it is defined as a plastic particle that is less than 5 millimeters in any one dimension. And the 5 millimeters was actually chosen specifically because it was thought that that size was something that was more respirable and easier to get inside of people. And it also was easier to be consumed accidentally by organisms in the environment. So as a scientist, I have to point out that microplastics doesn't follow our understanding of units. So we define them on a millimeter scale, but we call them microplastics. But that's based off of just trying to emphasize that they're very small in size. And the majority of microplastics out there are much, much smaller than that 5 millimeter cutoff. And when you get down to really small plastics, you enter the world of nanoplastics, which are even smaller.
And I'll just add that it is important to think of microplastics not just as this one singular thing, because they're really a suite of contaminants. You know, they're made from different types of plastic, they're different colors, they're different shapes, but they all have the shared characteristics of breaking down over time into smaller pieces and absorbing and releasing chemicals into our environment.
When was it that we first really started understanding just how devastating microplastics are?
I'm happy to dabble into that. A couple things. you know, the, as Sally said, the term microplastics has only been around for about 20 years. And in those early years, you know, in 2005, 2006, when we were first sort of batting this name around, there's very little research done on this, but it piqued people's interests. And since then, you know, now there's hundreds and there's thousands of studies that have been done on microplastics. In those early days, we focused on studying microplastics in the ocean. And I think that's why there's such this association with plastics and seafood and in the ocean, is because that's what we've really first started studying. And now that we've broadened this field of research, we're seeing that plastics are really everywhere. It's not a seafood problem. It's not just an ocean problem. It's a river problem. It's a mountain problem. It's a bottled water problem. It's a beef problem. The plastics are really pervasive through our entire environment. But that those first studies really put that in the eye of the public. The garbage patch, which I personally think is kind of a misnomer. It gives people this idea that there's this floating island that you could like walk on or build on way out in the ocean. And there's actually five major ones of these, but I really think it's important to think of this as almost like a plastic smog, because you can't, you know, if you went out there in a boat, you're not really going to see this plastic. You might see some fishing debris and things like that that are caught in these convergent zones, these current zones that trap it out there, but you're not going to physically see something that you could put your foot onto. Mm-hmm. But that captured the imagination of people. Right. And I think that was a really important tool, but I think there needs to be more education around what that actually looks like in the real world. And that's why microplastics are so insidious, is because you can't really see them. They're one of these large, enormous pollution problems that we have that you can't quite lay eyes on.
When you say that you can't lay eyes on them, but we know they're there and they're such a big problem, how do you then analyze these? What are the steps and what technology do you use to analyze microplastics in areas like the ocean or in the mountains? How do you calculate that?
First, I think it's important to recognize that one of the issues in the field is we don't have a standard way to capture or analyze microplastics. And so that makes it very difficult to compare plastic levels between locations, because everyone's doing it slightly differently. And so studies are really difficult to compare. And so the first thing is, how do you isolate the microplastics? For big water studies, oceans, lakes, even rivers, people will use nets. And then the question is, how big are the holes in your net? Because then you're losing all the plastics that are smaller than that hole size, right? Mm-hmm. So you could be missing out on the bulk of the plastics if the net has holes that are too big. And so that's a big discussion point. After you filter out the particles, you then need to figure out how to identify what's plastic. And so sometimes that's done with like a density separation. So plastics are often lighter. They're less dense than a lot of other natural materials like sand and things like that, but not all of them. So again, if you do that, you could be missing some of the plastics. And then by eye, not all plastics are colored. And so some studies will look through a microscope and try to find plastics by eye. Maybe you're only trying to find the blue and the red and the greens, but what about all the ones that are colorless? Are you able to find those? And so we can take some advantages of plastic properties. So there's a cool method where you can actually use a fluorescent label, and this molecule will stick onto things that are hydrophobic like plastics, and it makes them light up. And so you're able to shine a light on your sample and make all the plastic stuff glow. And you hope that all the glowing stuff is only plastics and not something else. So there's the whole thing there. And ultimately, what you do is we use light methods to try to identify what kinds of chemicals there are present in our sample. And so we can say, oh, there's polyethylene present, which is like a plastic shopping bag, or there's polypropylene, which used to be like a milk jug. And so we get some information there. But there's a lot of different techniques that are available to answer that kind of question too. And they all have slightly different advantages and disadvantages. So it's a complex question. How do you isolate and analyze microplastics? And there's a lot of solutions to that question. And one of the big things going forward, I think, is that if we as a society decide to try to regulate or monitor microplastics, we're going to need to decide on some unifying methods for the field.
Yes. And on that note, I also would say that we have baseline data. We do understand that it is in most places that we look. And so I think that continued research is really important. Method and data harmonization is essential, but that we have enough information to enact and think about upstream policies that will reduce the amount of plastic that is going into our environment.
Mm-hmm. And in your research, Abby, how were you analyzing microplastics in the ocean to come up with some of these data sets?
Great question. Yeah, so I got into the field when it was still really nascent and just emerging. And so I was really focused on that methodology. And at the time, I was doing water quality monitoring here in Maine, in the islands around here, to better understand water quality in general and the health of our ecosystems. And so I started to incorporate microplastics sampling into our weekly monitoring, and I tried using a tow net, basically a phytoplankton net with that mesh size that is, you know, maybe allowing for many things to slip through. And I did a side-by-side comparison doing whole water samples, or grab samples, we call them. So scooping up a liter of water out of the surface of the ocean, and did a side-by-side comparison looking at volume. And we realized that by just using nets, we were underestimating the amount of plastics in the ocean by an order of almost 3 magnitudes. And so for me, that was really telling that to move forward, it seemed like incorporating that whole water sample, that grab sample, was really a more reflective way of sampling the ocean and getting a better understanding of what the microplastics concentrations are in our aquatic systems. So with that knowledge, and after that publication, I went on to work with this nonprofit called Adventure Scientists, which is based in Montana, and they connected me with adventurers. So basically, citizen scientists on steroids that were able to go to all these different places in the world, you know, kayak in the Arctic, or sail across, you know, some remote piece of water, or row in the Pacific. And they followed a streamlined field protocol that I developed to collect water samples. And they shipped those water samples to me, and I processed them over a very small filter in my lab. So trying to capture all the way down to 0.45 microns, so right before the nanoscale of these plastics, to get a better snapshot of what was going on in our oceans and in our freshwater systems.
Oh, we love citizen science here at This Green Earth. I think it's great that there are people that are being involved in helping you collect this data. This tends to ripple out. The more educated you are, the more you care. It seems to end in action. And so I think it's so great that you did it that way. I also want to talk about a term that I just found out. The term is nurdle nuisance. Can you define that and describe what that means?
Well, I'll start, and I'm sure Abby can add a lot more since she focuses on marine environments. So the majority of plastics are produced in Asia, and we make these feedstocks of plastics. And instead of making giant cubes, that's like a chunk of plastic, the plastics are all chopped up. And they're made into these tiny little pellets. And those pellets are called nurdles. And then the nurdles are put on ships, and they're moved all over the world. And they get to whatever country, and then they're converted into a chair or a cell phone case or whatever final product we use. So they're basically like the initial feedstock for consumer products. And they're a nuisance because nurdles fill off ships, and ships sink and catch fire and release nurdles into the environment. And so we have a major problem with nurdles being released into the oceans. And they're by definition already microplastics. Most of them meet those criteria already, and they can be consumed by fish. They can travel on ocean currents long distances. They can impact ecosystems, etc. And there are citizen science groups on coastal areas that actually are on nurdle watches that patrol the beaches and try to look for nurdles that are washing up on the shore, because that would indicate like a container full of these plastic particles fell off a ship somewhere. And then some kind of cleanup might be possible. And I'm sure Abby has more to add to that.
That was very comprehensive. Thank you. So, you know, such a cute name for this, like, really kind of nasty little product. So the one really great program is called the International Pellet Watch. And this was started by Dr. Takada in Japan. And I am not sure what the status of that project is now, but they have published a lot of data over the years. And basically, they were looking for people who found nurdles on their local beaches or along the coastline, and they would ask you to send them the nurdles, you know, so it might just be a handful or it might be three. And they would analyze those nurdles to look at the chemical concentrations that had adsorbed and been absorbed into the plastic. And they found that these plastic pellets sometimes had up to a million magnitudes higher concentrations of pretty nasty chemicals. So think of PFAS, think of DDT, think of BPAs, adhered onto the surface of that plastic. And that's what is, to me, the kernel of information that's really important, because those plastics, as we know, and as Sally just highlighted, they spill, they travel all around the environment, they go into our animals, they are transported through our oceans, and they are picking up chemicals and then also leaching them out. And so that study was really an eye-opening study to better understand how plastics are impacting our environment and how, because they persist, they have this ability to transport chemicals and potentially other pathogens into different environmental compartments.
A lot of people are focused on this image of microplastics getting into their bodies, and they're really worried about these particles in them. But most people don't realize what the plastics can bring with them. And I think that's the bigger issue. So microplastics are like sponges of things in the environment. So pesticides, herbicides, all these things can associate with plastic surfaces, even heavy metals. And it makes the plastic particle like a little Trojan horse, where it can enter an organism and it brings with it all of these other harmful contaminants at a much higher concentration than what they would be like in just the bulk environment. And then you couple that with what the plastic originally had inside of it when it was manufactured. We have all kinds of additives in our plastics, and that's to make sure that they have the right kind of UV properties, the right flexibility, the right color, the right gas transfer properties. And all of these compounds are locked between these long strings of polymers. And when that plastic starts breaking apart, they get released into the environment. The danger of microplastics isn't just the plastic particle, it's what they bring into the environment and release, and it's what they absorb from the environment and then can bring into us.
I think you had said this, Abby, that it is the unseen danger. And so when it starts to circulate in our bodies and it can become an attractant for something even worse inside our bodies, and we're seeing this going into not only our oceans, but right here in Utah and particularly Park City, we're finding plastics in our snowpack, and we talk a lot about PFAS here because this is what we put on our skis, and we have systems here in our community to try to mitigate that. But can you talk about outside of the ocean where we're finding this in our mountains and in our snowpack?
I could talk a little bit about that, and that I have studies ongoing right now looking at microplastics in our snow, and everywhere in the world, the snow has microplastics. And that's because microplastics move throughout the environment, not just in the water, but also in the air. So you can think about there being almost like a plastic cycle, where plastics are able to be transported through water, and then they're lifted off that water through wave action and wind and go back into the air, and they can travel a very long distance. They get pretty high into the atmosphere. So when we have snow precipitating, we actually have dust and plastics in that snow. So fresh snow isn't really perfectly clean, right? Mm. And so we find microplastics in the snow just from the sky. And then we're currently doing a study looking at the impact of outdoor recreation on microplastic content in snow. And we see that where there's people, there's more microplastics. And part of that is because outdoor clothing is entirely synthetic. And so people are shedding clothing fibers, and those are microplastics into the snow. But we're also seeing the impact of ski waxes and even the bases of skis. We can see plastic particulate shedding. So the act of skiing or snowboarding, snowmobiling with those plastic treads on the snowmobiles, you're able to actually add more plastics into the snowpack through those activities.
We try to move in the way of hope on this program. So what are some of the solutions? At this point, we can't get rid of the problem, but how do we help ourselves move forward so we're not exacerbating it?
That's a great question. And I feel like it's a common one. And it always gives me hope that people want to make changes and see how they can help reduce this problem. There is so much that we can do. I think it's really important to, the first step is education. So listening to programs like this, we are only limited by our imagination. There's still lacking a lot of alternatives to single-use plastic and plastic. But I think that if you push yourself a little bit, you can be creative and find ways to reduce the plastic in your everyday life. So everything from, you know, maybe not going out to eat as much, or bringing takeout containers, switching out what kind of containers you put your food in your house, and moving away from plastic containers there. I can talk a lot about the household things, which are fairly easy fixes, and do have a lot of great alternatives. You know, everything from not using plastic dishwasher pods and things like that. So I live on a little island, and the ocean has always been a really big part of my life, and it's a lobstering community where I live, but the oceans are changing. And I saw the opportunity with oyster farming to model a sustainable business that could be supplemental or be something that someone could pivot to as our waters and our fisheries changes. Oysters are this amazing powerhouse keystone species that filters water and dramatically improves the quality of the ecosystem in the area that it's in. And I was so attracted to these animals. And then as I got into farming, I realized every single thing that we used to grow oysters relied on plastic. So everything from the bottom paint on our boat to the lines that we're running, those are all nylon or a poly blend. The floating bags that we grow oysters in on the surface so we can tend them are all HDPE plastics. Zip ties, you know, the list goes on and on. And it was really disheartening that we had this amazing animal, this amazing opportunity to create a very sustainable and robust fishery or aquaculture. And yet the materials we were using were the antithesis of what we were trying to do in terms of being stewards of the environment and building a better ecosystem. And so I decided to pull in some of my background in water quality and think about what the future of aquaculture could look like without using plastic. And so for the past 5 years, that is the question that has been driving me almost every day. And it turns out it's really hard to find viable alternatives to plastic. As I said before, the reason we use plastic is, well, there's a lot of different reasons, but one is because it's very functional. It doesn't corrode, it's lightweight, it's relatively cheap. You know, you can pick it up and toss it around. And so finding something that can still perform and that is scalable and financially viable for oyster farmers to turn to as an alternative plastic to plastic has been a real challenge. But I feel like we've made leaps and bounds, and we are now starting to scale up components of our prototype gear. And this summer, I will be establishing the first fully plastic-free oyster farm from the moorings up. So no plastic ropes, no plastic buoys, and no plastic gear to grow food in.
So using yourself as a model to see how we can move forward in our lives and take away some of the ways that we are adding to the problem, what are some of the day-to-day things that people can do that could move the needle?
So there are a lot of easy things that you can change in your daily routine. So a very easy thing that most people are definitely aware of is say no to single-use plastics where you can. bring cloth bags to the grocery store, right? That's what we're talking about with single-use plastics. Single-use plastics have an incredibly short lifetime. They're produced, used, and discarded within months. And when they're discarded, they're big plastics that turn into small plastics. So you can really make a huge impact on the environment by doing a reduction of single-use plastic use. If you're worried about the environment and your own body, there's other things, of course. So that would be a lot of changes in your kitchen. So when you prepare your food, are you cutting your food on a plastic cutting board or on maybe a composite or a wood cutting board? Change to the not plastic, and you can reduce the amount of microplastics that are being entrained in the food as you're cutting it. Heating up your food in the microwave, try to heat in something that's glass or ceramic, not plastic. That will help reduce the amount of particles that are transferring into your food while it's being heated, for example. Single-use plastic water bottles are a huge problem, both for the environment and for your health. Best not to use them at all if you can. If you habitually use single-use plastic water bottles, you can increase your plastic consumption at least twofold. So you want to make sure not to do that. Other ideas, if you're worried about what's in your air and your drinking water, there are point-of-use filters that are sold. So you can look into this. There's little filters that look kind of I'm trying to think about how big they are. There's a few inches long, but they'll thread onto your kitchen faucet, for example, and help reduce the particulate matter that's in your drinking water coming out of your faucet. And you can also get air purifiers for your home if you're worried about plastic particulates in your air. So there are some great things you can do to try to reduce the amount of particles that you're ingesting and inhaling. I would also like to point out for babies, a big source of microplastics would be baby bottles. So you might want to consider switching to glass baby bottles, which I know are super inconvenient, but because they're heavy and they're breakable. But it would, because you're heating bottles often, it is a big impact to try to switch from plastic to an alternative material like glass for baby bottles.
Well, there is so much to discuss here, and I could ask you a million more questions. I know you speak a lot on this topic, and you'll actually be together in our backyard here on April 14th, and you'll be speaking at the Natural History Museum of Utah. I believe it's sold out. So unfortunately, there aren't any tickets left, but it tells you how important this is to our state and our communities here. But if people want to learn more about your studies and the two of you, Sally, I'll have you start. Where can they go? What website can they check out? Or how can they further their research?
People are welcome to check me out at Utah Valley University's website, just Sally Rocks. For general information on microplastics, there are some excellent resources that are produced by the United Nations. They have a wonderful overview of microplastics and current science. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, also has some great microplastic resources for the public that are just really helpful for understanding where we are in this problem. What do we know? What remains to be done?
And Abby, you?
Yes, so I have a website, abbybarrows.com, and also dearisleoysterco.com. And I have been really lucky to have a lot of media as of late. And so if you're interested in watching either a short TV episode or a short film, you can check out Women of the Earth series on PBS. And it's the oyster and microplastic episode, and that's available on YouTube. I also have a film with Patagonia, also on YouTube, called We Can Get There From Here, through their workwear line. And that features my journey through trying to change plastic use in the aquaculture world. And I also have a film that just came out with SC Johnson and Rain Shadow Productions, called The Human Side of Microplastics. And that will actually be featured at the International Ocean Film Festival in San Francisco next weekend.
That's great. You're busy.
Yeah, I'm busy.
So famous.
Maine famous. I also did want to say that even though the microplastics panel discussion is sold out at the Natural History Museum of Utah next in a week and a half, there is a keynote speaker, biologist turned photographer and National Geographic explorer Ananda Varma, speaking at the Natural History Museum of Utah on April 21st. And so there are still tickets available for that. And if I was local, I would be buying them right now.
That's a great series that they have going there. We are speaking with Abby Barrows, a leading microplastics research scientist and founder of Deer Isle Oyster Company, and Dr. Sally Rocks, an associate professor of chemistry at Utah Valley University. We appreciate you for being a part of this Green Earth.
Thank you very much.